Good morning. Let's get started. Good morning and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation. And I first want to just say I'm really glad this is not on a Friday when we are expecting a major snowstorm. So let's hear it for that. But thank you very much for coming today to our event focused on the future of U.S. global health policy and programs. As we all know and are probably thinking about, for those of us here, 2016 could be a pretty consequential year for U.S. global health policy. We'll have a new president voted in after 8 years of the Obama administration and also after the Bush administration, two administrations that have been strong supporters of global health efforts, and we'll have congressional elections. Also on the global health front in 2016, the U.S. joins the rest of the world in the post-2015, post-Paris climate conference period of international development, just as there's reemerging concerns about security and other foreign policy crises around the world. As we all know, global health has enjoyed strong bipartisan support, not seen in most other areas of government, and that has weathered many changes in administrations and Congress. And I don't think any of us would have expected that level of support 15 years ago when this all began. But there does remain an open question about the future, not necessarily because of global health specifically, but the larger climate and with changes on the horizon. There are several questions that we want to consider. How will the global health policy baton be passed to new leaders in the U.S.? Could the transitions affect what has been a pretty durable bipartisan support, or are there new opportunities that we can look ahead towards? So we wanted to convene an event today in the new year to talk about these issues as the presidential campaigns heat up and to really discuss with experts and you what your thoughts are and concerns and questions and opportunities. Before we go on to that, I just want to first thank my amazing team at Kaiser Family Foundation for pulling this event together. We have overflow. There's a lot of people here. And just want to call out in particular Josh Michaud, who's the Associate Director of Global Health Policy and sort of my thought partner in crime, and Katie Smith, who does our communications and made this event happen. So thanks to both of you and everybody else at Kaiser. So first, to feed into the conversation we're going to have with panelists today, we are releasing several new studies. They're in your packet. They're online. We have an analysis of the final spending for fiscal year 16. We have a new poll of the American public on global health, and we have some new research conducted with foreign policy and global health experts. And I'm going to give a short overview of some highlights from these analyses before we go to the panel. So first, some highlights. I want to start with the budget. And to do that, I need to give a shout-out to Adam Wexler and Allison Valentine at Kaiser, who really led this analysis, looking at the final spending bill for 2016 that was approved in December, and where global health ended up. And as you can see from this graph, sort of looking at the long picture, there's some good news and challenging news here. The good news is that global health has been relatively flat. This is all of the global health funding that can be identified in the budget. And as you see, it's been relatively flat, which is not a bad story in the current climate. And in fiscal year 15, you see that bump. That's the emergency Ebola funding, which is a little bit of a different entity, but it's important to acknowledge. Also, not shown here, but it's in our report, global health has grown as a share of the international affairs-based budget because it continues to stay steady while the base budget has declined. So I think that's, you know, some good news. Also, interestingly, if you look at the past few years, Congress has continued to appropriate slightly greater amounts for global health than the president has actually requested, showing on both sides, you know, there's strong bipartisan support for global health programs in the midst of a pretty tight budget climate. And this just shows the pie of the programs for fiscal year 16, showing that, as we've seen for many years, HIV and the Global Fund are the majority of the funding. But what's not shown here are some of the key trends, and we have those in our report. So for HIV, for example, that funding has been relatively flat and is actually lower than the peak, which was in 2010. And we know that the epidemic is bigger than it was in 2010. So these are some ongoing challenges. So now I want to highlight some findings from a new poll that we're releasing this morning on Americans' views on the U.S. role in global health, something we've been tracking in depth since 2009. So we have some trend data. And several of my colleagues who are in our California office worked on this poll, Bianca DiGiulio, Mira Norton, and Molly Ann Brody. So thanks to them who led this analysis. And just some highlights that I hope will help, you know, provide a backdrop for our conversation. One is most Americans want the U.S. to play a major or leading role in world affairs. And actually, if you look by party identification, Republicans are more likely to say a leading role than Democrats. So there's a strong bipartisan support for the U.S. engagement in the world. And I think that's a positive story. But when we ask about global health, is the U.S. doing enough? Most people say the U.S. government's already doing enough to improve health in developing countries. And this looks at a whole range of other actors, and you can see where the U.S., where the public feels more could be done. So this is not necessarily a bad thing, but people feel like the U.S. has been engaged. But also we find that nearly half say the U.S. contributes more than its fair share to global health. And that's something you can look at the data, and the U.S. does provide the lion's share of funding for global health in the world. But that fair share belief is really driven by views of Republicans who are almost two-thirds say that the U.S. is contributing more than its fair share compared to about a third of Democrats who say that. So there's a partisan difference in what the U.S. should be doing and how the U.S. should be engaging in global health. Let me go right to spending. We look at spending, we find some mixed findings. First of all, we find that about about 60% say the U.S. Spends too little or about the right amount on global health, while 30% say too much. So the most people are saying we should do more or stay the course where we are. But if you look at party ID, you see that more Republicans say that the U.S. is spending too much, while Democrats say it's spending too little. So there's a real difference there below the surface on what we should be doing in terms of funding. Also not shown on the slides, but it's in our report, there are some concerns about the effectiveness of funding, and we've seen this over the years polling the public. It's not specific to global health, but there's concerns about the effectiveness of foreign aid spending and concerns that more spending will not necessarily lead to progress. And we see that also there's a gap by party on this, and that's been widening. Of course, what's driving some of this, not shown here, but in the report, is that great slide that we always have. How much do we spend on foreign aid? And as we know, the public overestimates this dramatically. In this latest poll, the average was 31% of the federal budget is spent on foreign aid. Yes. So that would be a whole different ballgame, and we're not there. But despite these differences, I think it's important to really underscore that half or more of Republicans, independents, and Democrats do say the U.S. is spending about the right amount or too little on global health. And most Americans say, when we ask, why should we be doing this work? What's important about this work from your perspective in the world? It's the moral reason. It's because it's the right thing to do. And these other arguments that we use and we think are important do resonate to some extent. But really, it's at least from when you ask the average American, it's because they think it's the right thing that we should be doing in the world. And I think that's important to remember. And then another finding that we've been tracking over time, we ask, well, how should the U.S. engage? Should the U.S. kind of do it alone or engage with international partners? And there's a growing desire to have the U.S. engage with others. And I think in the kind of climate that we all know is in the backdrop, that's potentially a good message, particularly in the SDG era, when we know that there's an increasing reliance on the role of multilateral institutions in the future. This is really a statement from Americans that the way the U.S. works with others is important on global health. So this is really just a very short snapshot of a much longer report that I wanted to provide highlights from. And I also now want to just turn over to some new research that we also worked on with Hart Associates and Public Opinion Strategies with Jeff Guerin and Elizabeth Harrington. We asked them if they could talk to foreign policy and global health experts in the D.C. environment and get a sense from them on a smaller scale, qualitative sense, you know, where is the future here? So I'm going to turn it over to them, let them provide some highlights there, then we'll come back to our panel. So Jeff and Elizabeth, thank you.
Morning, everybody. So I'm Jeff Guerin of Heart Research Associates. We do research on a lot of topics. Our work in the electoral sphere is on the Democratic side. Elizabeth Harrington is a partner at Public Opinion Strategies. They do work on a lot, and Liz will come up and speak to you in a moment. They do a lot of work on a lot of different topics, but all of their political work is on the Republican side. So this was intentionally very much of a bipartisan project, and in that regard, we were very deliberate about making sure that in speaking with experts and that we were talking both to Democrats and Republicans and people who come at this from a center-right perspective as well as a center-left perspective. This was all qualitative in nature. Some people we talked with in a group setting, some people we spoke with on an individual basis, but we spoke with 51 prominent people who work in this field, either work generally in foreign assistance more broadly, or global health more specifically. Of those 51, 22 are people who are engaged every day in the policy making process. One positive piece of news out of this is, in a way that is somewhat reflective of what you just heard from the public, is that among both Democrats and Republicans, there is a view that the United States government should continue to play a leadership role in global health. There is that this is at a time when there's not a lot of points of consensus that cut across party lines. This is one of one that does. There's a common view that our engagement in global health is in our self-interest, that treating and preventing infectious diseases elsewhere is an important protection for Americans, that it leads to greater stability, it creates better economic partners, and that it also advances goodwill to the United States. As you saw reflected in the poll of the public, there is also a fundamental sense that supporting global health is part of our national character and a kind of a moral obligation given our wealth and our leadership in the world. And again, that is a view that cuts across party and ideological divides. And then finally, in a kind of a very practical sense, relative to other areas of foreign assistance spending, there is a sense that the spending and investments we make in global health are more likely to pay off in success and create high returns. When we ask people about what's working and what's not working, there's a sense that there have been a lot of very, very important successes, that they are the product of thoughtful coalitions, that there have been clear targets in our spending with measurable goals, that unlike other areas of government spending, there is ongoing bipartisan support for spending in the global health sector, and that and more on the Democratic and left-leaning respondents, people credit the Millennium Development Goals in providing kind of a focus and an organizing principle for a lot of what's gone on in the past decade in global health. There are kind of areas of concern that are distinctive throughout, that there's a common concerns about lack of coordination among various stakeholders, that too much of the initiatives are siloed and don't recognize appropriate intersections. And one of the takeaways from the Ebola crisis is an underlying weakness in the monitoring and management of infectious diseases. There is some concern that U.S. government funding crowds out other initiatives that might be taking place. That in terms of looking ahead and what might affect the future trajectory of our engagement in global health, There is a expectation from both the left-leaning and right-leaning respondents that we are entering a kind of a world of global conflict, mass migration, and the was witnessed by the current refugee crises that create new vulnerabilities to disease and will create new requirements for global health investments. Democrats, but not Republicans, talk about the impact that climate change might and have on various factors affecting global health. And that one thing that we heard that was a little bit new is that there will be a greater need over time to address non-communicable diseases in developing countries where there are aging populations, but no real health systems to deal with non-communicable diseases, heart disease, mentioned most frequently. There is we hear pretty frequently throughout the research a desire for more sustainable and solutions to global health, building stronger health systems with more knowledgeable, with greater kind of local knowledge on the ground around these issues. But that's not to say people want to turn their back on things that are working well. And there is a sense that our priorities ought to include extending our wins, particularly with regard to HIV/AIDS, malaria, and maternal and child health mortality. There is a demand, really, from both sides of the aisle for greater integration and coordination between the various, both the various actors in global health and the various funding streams for global health. They believe that the United States government has an important role to play in global health and has certain unique capacities that need to be part of the toolkit for addressing global health needs. I mentioned in terms of priorities that our respondents identified, there is, in addition to maintaining momentum in prevention and treatment of infectious diseases and addressing maternal health and child mortality, there's an interest in investing in greater surveillance and response to avert pandemics, the salience of that obviously raised by the Ebola crisis, and people referring to that pretty consistently. We'll see the durability of that interest, but it was omnipresent at the time we did this research. These investments in self-sufficiency and sustainability. And they're also another one of the takeaways from the Ebola crisis is the need to rebuild key international institutions in the global health sector with some specific reference to the World Health Organization. Among our Republican respondents, there was an interest in a greater focus on initiatives where that are tied to clearly defined metrics and a greater measurement of success. In terms of their predictions and expectations for funding, while there is a consensus on both sides that our commitment to global health, or the U.S. government commitment to global health, ought to continue unabated, Democrats are a little bit more optimistic that that will be the case than our Republican respondents were. Democrats believe that in their Republican colleagues have a genuine commitment to global health funding. They cite various Republican leaders who are effective spokespeople and real advocates for this. But there's not an expectation that global that in the current budget environment that there's any kind of realistic prospect that that funding levels will be increased. The folks we spoke with on the Hill on the Republican side were a little less confident that funding would be maintained, had a greater sense of the challenge of that, both in terms of the politics around global health funding and the views of some members themselves who are more kind of inward looking. We asked people about their own sense of what works with that when they are being lobbied or when there's a debate about global health, what are the important issues. Among the respondents from the center left and the Democratic Hill staffers, they focus on the moral argument that you saw reflected in the poll that Jen mentioned. Republican members, respondents, thought it was very important to accentuate the national security aspects of these issues. And both Democrats and Republicans, people on the left and the right, also thought that a key case for our continued investment in global health is the fact that disease is communicable. And this is an important investment in protecting the health and the lives of Americans. They think that there are some arguments that the people in the global health community often make that don't resonate quite as much. They think that you can overplay the extent to which investments in global health will alleviate terrorism and the inclination to anti-American feeling. That you can overplay the economic argument, and on the Republican side a little bit more, the idea that there's deep appreciation in the world for our global health investments. Finally, we asked our respondents who they thought are the most important advocates, what voices are most important to bring to bear in making the case for global health. They start with people who have health expertise, whether they're in the World Health Organization or the Centers for Disease Control or National Institutes of Health. They think the voices of NGOs and on-the-ground practitioners are very important to bring to bear, the faith-based community, military and national security leaders, well-known private individuals and funders, I think with specific reference to Bill Gates. Some mentioned celebrities, and then from the right, they think it is important to bring to bear the voices of people who are known conservatives, and from the left, they think President Obama has a particular capacity to grab attention for this, but also bringing corporate voices to bear. So with that background on the research, very quick tour, I think you have more detailed analysis and summary of our findings. Let me call Liz Harrington to the stage to say a few words about the findings among Republicans.
Hi. So I'm just going to highlight a couple of things that Jeff already went over and point out a little differences on the right. So I think it's important that there's across both Republicans and Democrats that we did this research with in terms of the policy leaders, there's support for the U.S. Playing a leadership role in global health. And while Democrats think of it as a moral obligation, Republicans talk about it as our responsibility as being part of a world leader, as well as our resources. The priorities that both parties focus on are addressing specific diseases, eradicating them, strengthening sustainable health systems, and the preventative care. In terms of the focus, though, I think when they think and talk about kind of that shift to sustainable systems, it's difficult in the light of eradicating disease because a lot of folks want immediate results from the investment. And so I think the focus tends to be where you can see measurable results the fastest. On the right, there is this greater concern to make sure funding is tied to specific measurable results, specific actual metrics, so that we can monitor the successes as well as the return on investment of the funding. In terms of initiatives that are funded, they also feel that way in terms of they want it to be evidence-driven so that the initiative should be driven based on kind of the evidence from past successes. They want us to also better determine kind of the effectiveness of current global health programs to make sure that the funding that is being used appropriately. And then they want an expansion of this public-private partnership. I think that was part of the findings on the right, is that we can better leverage our dollars, our funding dollars, if we expand public-private partnerships. In terms of the funding levels, we did this research in between September and November, and it's qualitative in nature again. Although the Republicans were a bit more skeptical about the funding levels being maintained, they did say most respondents did believe that they would be maintained. They thought that the environment that could shift that maintenance of the funding in terms of any decreases might be any strain on budget constraints, as well as if any specific threats or immediate prevalent threats arose. Where the funds might be diverted or needed to be diverted for. In terms of the national security message, I think it's really a three-pronged message for the Republicans. They do see, so tying global health to national security is important for them. They do see preventing disease on U.S. soil as a national threat, national security threat. And then they also see a need for tying global health to, you know, that political unrest can happen where people are unhealthy. And so there's this hope that, you know, the U.S. steps in before another country steps in like China or Russia. So when you're talking about the national security message to them, it's two-pronged in terms of preventing it affecting us as well as kind of our responsibility and then making sure that that others don't step in. And so that's kind of the difference on the right. And I'll turn it back over to Jen.
Great. Thanks very much. If there are questions about that research, we'll just take them at the end when we open up to general questions. But I just want to say, you know, this, while it's qualitative in nature, and we did ask that they taught that Jeff and Elizabeth talked to experts in the field, I think it's interesting that the level of awareness about global health programs investments is relatively high. And if we thought 10 years ago or not talking to folks on the Hill, we might not have had that knowledge. So I think it's a real testament to all the work that people have done to really raise awareness and the programs being effective on the ground. So with that, I'd like to ask our panelists to come up here and we'll start our discussion. So as I mentioned earlier, is this on? Are we good? Okay. The purpose of the research that we released today was really as a backdrop. The sort of heart of this event is hearing from the experts up here. When I and others at Kaiser thought about having this discussion, we actually identified these people and said these are the folks that we would want to hear from to help shed light on this current moment and looking ahead. So I first want to, you know, thank them all for making time and being here with us. I'm going to briefly introduce them, and then I'm going to start asking them some questions. We'll have a dialogue, and then we'll open it up to you. So there are full bios in the packets. I will just say some brief highlights, and brief because all of them have a very long list of many accomplishments that they have done and are doing. First, I'm very happy to have here, and we really thank him for being here, Tommy Thompson, who's the chairman and CEO of Thompson Holdings, and as we all know, the former Secretary of Health and Human Services and four-term governor of Wisconsin. Governor Thompson really was one of the architects of PEPFAR and was there in the beginning, so we're going to talk to him about that. We also have Ambassador-at-Large Debbie Birx, who's the coordinator of the U.S. government activities to combat HIV/AIDS of PEPFAR, and the U.S. Special Representative for Global Health Diplomacy. As we know, she's a world-renowned expert on HIV. She's been working in that field for more than three decades and is somebody that I turn to when I have questions about how we can, you know, move ahead on HIV, and we're really glad that you are here. Thank you. We also are thrilled to have Dr. Helene Gale, who is the CEO of McKinsey Social Initiative, which is a nonprofit organization that addresses complex global social challenges. Previously, we know that she worked as the CEO of Care USA for many years. Prior to that, was at the Gates Foundation and was for 20 years at CDC and also at USAID. So has a long history of working in different sectors on HIV and global health. And then finally, Steve Morrison, who's a senior vice president at CSIS and director of its Global Health Policy Center, and really a key partner of the Kaiser Family Foundation and someone we work very closely with. And when I have, you know, when I need some input or expertise on something, I call Steve. So we're really, really excited that you're here today. And Steve also has worked in the Clinton administration and worked on the Hill, so has a long history of working on these issues. And I think one common element that everybody here has in terms of their backgrounds is we've all been working on these issues before they became the issue that we talked about and cared about and before funding increased, before there was a lot of attention, and have seen that change. I think that perspective is really important now and one of the reasons we asked all of you to be here. So to get us started, I'm going to turn to Governor Thompson. And I just want to get a sense from you, given the senior role that you played in the administration that created PEPFAR, can you provide your insight and thoughts on the challenges or opportunities really for moving this agenda forward in this next phase?
Absolutely, Jen. First off, I got to give you a little history, because what I'm telling you today has never really been written. Most of you don't even understand it or know it, but I'm going to quickly delve into it, because I was there at the start of not only PEPFAR, but also of the Global Fund. Kofi Annan called Colin Powell one weekend on a Saturday and said, I would like to come down and see if there's a chance that we could put together an initiative for the United States on the Global Fund. We can't do it without the United States. And Colin Powell said, sure, come on down. But he said, we got to have Tommy involved because he's Secretary of Health. So Colin Powell called me in Wisconsin on a Saturday night and asked me if I would come out and meet with him on Sunday afternoon, which I did. Met with Colin Powell, and we decided after a short meeting that we'd go see President George W. Bush on a Sunday afternoon. Now, the president doesn't like to work on Sunday afternoon. Nobody does. But we went over to the White House and talked to him about the Global Fund, and he bought into it. And he said, yes, he said, that sounds like a great idea. The next morning, Kofi Annan came down. We met with him, Colin and I did. We went over to the White House, and in the Rose Garden, President Bush announced $100 million for the Global Fund. That was the beginning of the Global Fund. And Congress then put $250 million in. Congress always raises a Republican president, so that's always good. So we had $250 million. And then I decided that I was really going to become active in it, and I became the second chairman of the Global Fund and was served in a longer capacity than anybody else has ever served in there. And I then went to took a group of 105 very distinguished people from all over the United States. We got on a plane in Germany to fly to Busia in in Kenya to take a look at a CDC outpost on AIDS. And there were so many highfalutin, high important people that we didn't use any fuel flying from Germany to Africa. We just floated on the hot air that was in that plane. And I made everybody go out and spend a day in a house with a person with HIV/AIDS. And we came out of that, and we decided to start medical diplomacy. And we went to an orphanage in South Africa. And I had Hank McKinnell, the head of Pfizer, with me. And we went into this orphanage, and the orphanage was just young children that had lost their mother. Their father had already died of AIDS, and these children were anywhere from just babies to 5 years old, all HIV positive. And Tony Fauci with me and says, if we gave these mothers novirapine, we would be able to prevent the transmission of AIDS from the mother to the child through breast milk. And I handed a child, I was holding a young baby, and all that baby wanted to do was be held and to be loved. And I handed one to Hank McKinnell. He said, didn't particularly want to pick up a child that was HIV positive, but did. And I could see a tear coming down his face, and he wrote out a very large personal check when we walked out of that orphanage. The reason I tell you that is because we Tony Fauci and I decided that we were going to fight very hard to get the South African government to give nevirapine to all expecting mothers. But the Minister of Health, who was a doctor in South Africa, said, no, you don't have to have nevirapine. All you have to do is boil potatoes and eat garlic and take showers, and you'll be able to stop the transmission of AIDS. And so we started a lawsuit, and on the way home on that trip, I told Tony, I said, we have got to do something about this. And so we came back and we initiated a plan to make sure that we could raise the money with the president's help on nevirapine to give it to all the expecting mothers in South Africa. And we had to get a lawsuit started against the South African government to allow us to do that. And when we went over to see George W. Bush, the president at that time, he says, well, that sounds great, but he says, that's not very big of a program. He says, why don't you go back and think larger? And so Tony Fauci and I went back, and Tony Fauci came up with the remnants and the basic outline of PEPFAR. I went back, and President George W. Bush endorsed it and supported it. And it was because of the fight against the Minister of Health in South Africa on nevirapine was the birth of the new plan that the president endorsed and now has become a very successful program that Debbie is running. And so it was a strange set of circumstances that we got the program adopted. And it has now been very successful. How do we continue? How do we expand it? I was listening to all of the facts and figures up here, but there was a tsunami that hit Indonesia. And right before the tsunami hit in Indonesia, Reuters had a poll in Indonesia, and they said that there was a real distaste, a hatred for America, 68-32. And after the tsunami hit, ladies and gentlemen, we sent one of our major floating hospital ships. It was either, I can't remember, it was the Comfort or I think it was the Comfort, and it was all volunteer help. And they stayed 6 weeks in Indonesia administering health. And what took place the day that they left were thousands of individuals from Indonesia come down to the port of Java to raise the American flag and to wave American flags thanking America for what they did. And then Reuters had a poll about a month to 2 months afterwards, and it was completely transposed. It was 68% of those people that were polled favored America. And that was the beginning of a new relationship with Indonesia because of global health. And it tells you, ladies and gentlemen, that it does work. And that's what we have to do. If you want Republicans, and I was listening to the to your report, Republicans want a cause. Now, if you really want, you know, you can have stable funding, but if you really want to win this, let's start a real battle to eliminate malaria. Malaria, there's no reason we have a malaria. But if you have an initiative where you got a cause and you're going to be able to raise money and be able to do something, you're going to be able to get Republicans strongly supporting it and be able to get the kind of money necessary for a particular cause, a cause and effect, and have some goals and have some accountability, and you're going to be able to get the Republicans to support it, and that's what we have to do. Democrats feel more like it's a moral cause. Republicans want to make sure that they stop the disease coming into the United States. We can do that together, and we can come up with a very exciting program. I don't know how many of you remember Jesse Helms, but Jesse Helms was adamantly opposed to any money going into AIDS. We were able to convince Jesse Helms to go with Bono, Sonny Bono, to go to Africa and see it. And what happened is that Jesse Helms came back and was the biggest advocate for more funding. Jesse Helms from North Carolina, who never saw a tax dollar should be spent any place, came back and authored the proposal for more money for that. So what I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm telling you, Jen, is we have a tremendous opportunity to make global health a cause célèbre, to be able to do it. And if Republicans see that it's an effective way to be able to convince individuals in those countries to be able to support the United States like we did in the tsunami in Indonesia. If we're able to convince strong conservatives like Jesse Helms that this is a cause worth supporting, we can develop a very strong, vigorous, vibrant bipartisan support. And that's what I noticed when I was Secretary of Health. That's why I got involved in the Global Fund and was the chairman of that. And that's why I was very much involved in setting up the PEPFAR program, which has been very effective. And George W. Bush will tell you today it's the best program he developed while he was president, even though it was Tony Fauci and Tommy Thompson that developed it. We never got the credit. But that, maybe that's his way. He's the president. He deserves it. But I'm just I talked too long. But it's an area that I'm somewhat passionate about, if you could tell. So thank you very much.
Thank you. That's actually a perfect segue to go to Ambassador Birx, who is, as you heard, running the largest program in the world, health program in the world focused on a single disease, PEPFAR, and it's the largest part of the U.S. global health investment. So really what happens to PEPFAR and its future is the future of U.S. global health in many ways. So what do you see as the opportunities, risks, things you want to highlight at this moment? And I know you have some slides.
Yeah, and I won't go through them in detail. I just think what you're doing right now, Jen, once again reminding us that the world continues to shift and we need to shift with it and we need to address the concerns that anyone might or should or will have. And I think that's the kind of proactive piece that you constantly have to be looking for. And I think we heard what you heard from the Republicans and the Democrats, and we heard this real issue of value for money and really showing our impact and changing from indicators to really outcomes and impact and measuring it very clearly. And so we've launched these prevalence and incidence studies around the globe in every PEPFAR country to really look at how much we've driven down incidence and prevalence. But more importantly, we heard your issue about multilaterals and working more closely. And you can't work closely with a multilateral unless you know what you're doing in a very precise way down to the site level. And so we very carefully mapped all of our data and what services we're providing down to the site level and then taken those diagrams and detailed information and meet with the fund portfolio managers of the Global Fund to make sure that we're not duplicating any single thing. Because you heard our budget was flat. What's not often told is President Obama more than doubled our investment in the Global Fund. So when you have a flat budget and you've doubled the investment in the global funds, it means the bilateral programs had to take a cut. And that is fine because what we have said then is we will figure out how to make every dollar go further and use data to drive our program for program improvement. And I think that reality of a flat budget or a declining budget really woke us up to say we have to really reach out to people. And I look at many of you around the audience who have been extraordinary partners of PEPFAR, driving innovation and changing how we're thinking. The other big piece of this, the world is moving so quickly, you can't look at data yearly. You can't look at data and say this is what we've done and we've looked at over the last 12 months. We've moved all of our data analysis to quarterly. I'm sure some of the partners in the audience know this, are very distressed with us. But we're really trying to be very specific and utilizing that information to work with governments and work with the Global Fund and work with donors around the world to show that we are being very responsible with what we're doing and then really launching bold initiatives with a public-private partnership like we did with DREAMS. A very aggressive program to drive down incidence in young women by 40%, launched with a whole series of the private sector partners to bring that innovation and knowledge. We launched ACT, the Accelerating Treatment for Children, again, with a private sector partner. I think that is bringing not just dollars, but knowledge for solutions for us to be more effective and focused. And finally, one thing I want to leave you with is we focus on dollars all the time, but policy changes can be a complete game changer. And I think we haven't focused enough on the translation of the WHO policies into action immediately. We are so proud that we're translating the great work of NIH all the time into an implemented program, from circumcision to test and start. All of this work is now, it's weeks rather than months. But then we have WHO guidelines that sit there for years that countries don't adopt. I just want to show you what is possible. Today we could double the number of people on treatment. And you might, in a level budget. And you say, how is that possible? And this shows how much it would drive down the epidemic. We would drive down the epidemic by more than 50% just in 5 years. And the reason it's possible is because WHO has recommended moving from every month of follow-up to every 3 to 6 months of follow-up. That's using the same health structure, the same infrastructure, and every health provider now can see twice as many patients because they're seeing them less frequently. It drives down the cost of drugs. It drives down the cost of laboratory. And the orange bars show the cost of seeing two clients per year versus one client per year. These are the kinds of business cases and innovations we need to work in partnership with the Global Fund and countries and partners to make this information real, because we will be held accountable as a multilateral group, as Americans, that we had the science and the tools to eliminate malaria and change the very course of the HIV/AIDS epidemic and therefore also drive down TB rates. And we didn't seize that moment. So I think we feel a real responsibility all the time. I think President Obama has done an amazing thing for us by announcing our targets at the interface of the MDGs and SDGs, because he says to everyone, the United States has unfinished business that we're committed to, and took that time to announce bold targets that cross into the next administration. So those are the kinds of things we feel are really critical. Responding to what the Hill concerns are and being very clear about that response, and then putting it up on a dashboard so everyone can see it, and then developing targets that cross administrations and keep us all accountable through that political change time. And President Obama did that for us. So I think it's really a very exciting time. I do believe that we can do more with the money we have. And we are about a third of our dollars are in the health system. If we want to take on non-communicable diseases, we have to create a structure that can see clients every 6 months. You're not going to be able to see people with diabetes and hypertension monthly. So we have to, right now, work with countries to develop that kind of approach. And we're excited about not only how we can change the very course of the HIV/AIDS epidemic and impact malaria and TB and maternal child health through PEPFAR, we're excited about creating the roadmap of the health system for the 21st century that can respond to these other non-communicable diseases in an effective way. So I think it's a great opportunity, and we're excited to be part of it.
Thank you. Even though some of you who are having to respond to regular data requests and needs, I think we can all say I'm not personally aware of another global health program that has data in real time that we now have with PEPFAR. So it speaks to a lot of the concerns we've heard and is, I think, a critical way forward. Before we move to Helene and Steve, I want to ask Governor Thompson another question. Because of what you've been doing since you left the public sector and your strong engagement in working in the private sector and staying focused on global and domestic health, and you've mentioned the private sector, and you did too. What do you see, and that's come up, what do you see as a way forward to increase that more or to make that involvement more well-known among policymakers?
In the business world where I am right now, and just for getting America excited, you have to have a cause. And you know, whether it be malaria, whether it be driving down AIDS by 50%, if there's a start and a finish, if you want Republicans to really get focused, you got to have a start and a finish. You got to have some goals and some accountability. And the business community is very much the same way. And I think, you know, whether it be neglected tropical diseases, which we could eliminate if we really wanted to, malaria, if we put the necessary emphasis on it, if we want to drive down AIDS 50%, if we went to America and said, for another, if everybody contributed, we raised some dollars, and we wanted to eliminate malaria in 5 years, like we wanted to eliminate polio or smallpox, which we have, is the only one. We're very close on polio. There's a beginning, an end, and a cause. And that's what the business community, just to say, well, let's spend another $100 billion on on foreign aid, you're not going to get the kind of enthusiasm. But if you can go into a round table, the business round table, and say, you know, if all of you contributed, you know, $5 million from your companies, and we can come up with a plan, and we have a plan to eliminate malaria in by 2020, you'd be amazed about how much money you could get and how many people would rally around it, and then invite those business people to Africa to see it. You know, seeing is believing, seeing having an opportunity, going into these villages and seeing what can be done and being able to set up a program. It'd be amazing what we could do together. But just saying, you know, we're going to spend another $100 billion or $10 billion, you know, to do it doesn't get you excited. But it gets you excited if you're going to eliminate something. You know, you're going to win, and America loves to win. So let's set up a program and how we go out there and corral something and win, and you can raise the dollars to get it done. Remember the Red campaign a few years ago? Everybody, you know, you got on a plane, everybody wanted to wear something red. Remember that? It was a cause. You know, you thought you were helping somebody with AIDS. You were going to be able to drive it down. That's what we got to do. Get some enthusiasm back in there like I am and be able to go out there, you know, and set up a program. Eliminate malaria. Why in the hell do we still have malaria? It's been around forever. And we know how to, you know, and how many kids do we kill every year with malaria? And it's stupid. You know, just go out there and let's develop a program, raise the money, and go out and do it. It would be amazed how many adherents, how many people would get excited about it. I'm sorry.
No, I think malaria advocates in the room are probably thrilled right now between that and the State of the Union. We're moving forward. So I'm going to turn over to Helene. Just a general, your thoughts hearing all of this. You served across multiple administrations in different capacities. You saw the sort of transition from a point in time when getting any attention to HIV was really difficult to a real bipartisan cause. And can you comment on that and what it might mean for today?
Yeah, okay, and I'm going to sound real dull compared to Secretary Thompson, but just to say I'm equally enthusiastic. I just maybe just don't get revved up quite as much. But anyway, thank you. Thanks for that enthusiasm. And I think it is that kind of enthusiasm that is incredibly important. And I'll just make a few reflections as I've listened to different, both the excellent presentations as well as the comments. And, you know, first, while it's always easy when you're listening and you're polling and you're almost trying to look at what distinctions are, to make the distinctions greater than they actually are. And I think one of the things that both of you pointed out is how much actual true bipartisan support there is, and that there are nuances, and we should probably pay attention to those nuances, but there is much about how you sell the issues versus what you do. And so I think first, you know, just listening to the polling information, let's use that to think about how do we sell our arguments and how are we smarter when we think about the different constituents that we want to reach on this issue. And, you know, to the point that several have made, I think the programs that we have, like PEPFAR, like the President's Malaria Initiative, like the Global Fund, are the kinds of things that galvanize people's, you know, get people's juices up, and people feel like there, you know, there is a cause and there is something, that there is a beginning and an end. But I do worry that if we only think about things in terms of almost sequential elimination efforts, that we're not going to get to the point where we're actually putting in place the infrastructures that are necessary so that when the Ebola's occur, or when we start facing the chronic disease epidemics that we know are really starting to be much more serious than a lot of the infectious disease killers that we've been dealing with, we're not going to be prepared. So I think we have to think smarter about how do we use, and Debbie talked about it well, using the PEPFAR platform to prepare us for the future, where we're also looking at the health infrastructure, but doing it through things that people can get excited about. You know, anybody who has ever tried to go and talk to Congress about health infrastructure, you know that people's eyes glaze over. And I used to do this when I was at CDC, and you tried to get people excited about infrastructure and surveillance and all of these sort of things. And, you know, the average person doesn't get excited about it. The average person gets excited when they look in the eyes of a child, right, and they know that they are going to make a difference by giving that child's mother nevirapine, et cetera. So, you know, we have to remember what it is that motivates people, but how do we use those motivations to then put in place the things that we want? And I think we have to be a little bit more aggressive in our ability to think smartly about this, because if we continue to focus on disease by disease, we are going to still be where we are, you know, a decade from now. And I think it is, the world is going to judge us, poorly if we've continued to see the next crisis not have the infrastructure in place. Lastly, I just think this issue around partnership, and particularly the private sector, is one that I think we haven't paid enough attention to. And, you know, increasingly, you know, if we look around the world, and in Africa, over 50% of funds in the health system are actually spent through private practitioners. And we've not given enough focus, because so much of our money is government money, so much of our infrastructure and so much of our work is through public sector. And I think we've really got to think a lot more about the opportunities with the private sector, and not just our private sector companies, but also the private sector healthcare workers in developing countries where most of the care is actually being done. And I think we're missing the boat by continuing to think public sector, and not looking at the private sector as an engine of change, an engine of innovation, and as a huge provider, and as a chance to stretch our dollars and leverage our resources a lot more. So,
I actually have a follow-up
and
for you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my follow-up is, it gets to a little bit to your point about what we focus on and how we do it. If we go for the shorter-term identifiable things, we don't want to do it at the expense of building infrastructure. One of the issues that I know that you are very much focused on now is the importance of addressing the health of women and girls and families. In fact, you're chairing a new CSIS task force on women and family health. Can you talk a little bit about that as an example, or not just an example, but a real fundamental view and approach to this interconnectedness of these issues and building that larger support?
Yeah, and that was the and that I was
Great.
About to throw in when you step back. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is one of those areas that can get people excited, because I think there's a whole range of issues around girls and women, you know, the disproportionate impact of HIV, for instance, on girls and women. And I think that as it's also tied to economics around the world, the McKinsey Global Initiative just put out a report that said $12 trillion could be unlocked in the economy around the world if we did right by girls and women and had gender parity. And that includes several major health issues like access to reproductive health services, as well as gender-based violence and issues like that. So we know that focusing on girls and women would be a great leading edge, and it is an issue, if framed well, that really does galvanize a lot of attention. And I think that it is one of those ways that we can have a greater integrated approach to health.
Steve, I definitely want to hear your thoughts on that too, but before that, I would love to get your broader take on the current political environment and what you see in this election year going ahead. I know you're not shy to share your views on this. And one other thing I'll ask about that is, with the next president, whoever it is, do you see room for a new global health initiative coming forward, or are we really looking at a steady state?
Okay. Thank you all. I want to answer that question with three quick points. One is, it's terribly important that we, as we've already begun, to sort of celebrate and congratulate the successes that have been here. And I think that the work that Adam Wexler did in the budget analysis, which is very important and very powerful, the work that Jeff Garron and Liz Harrington pulled together, and Molly and Brody and her team on the Kaiser family, the picture that those paint, when you read those together, the picture is very compelling and very positive. And around the continuity of support, the complexity of support, the strength of the coalition, and the fact that there has been, across several presidents now, an evolving commitment that has allowed for strong presidential leadership and continuity. Congratulations to Deborah for the State of the Union address, the president demonstrating to us the centrality of ongoing high-level presidential commitment and leadership. And this in a State of the Union address that we were told was devoid of major initiatives, but which made this very strong commitment on both HIV/AIDS and malaria, which is further testimony. On the other two points are, what are we going to make of the Obama administration as we enter this period of transition and think about the next phase, which will remain uncertain for some time? That is a debate that is beginning now, and I think there's a couple of very key points that we need to keep in mind. One I've already made, which is presidential leadership is the sine qua non. It is what we need to be targeting. We did not get to where we are were it not for the sequence of Clinton, Bush, Obama. And that cannot be broken. That has to continue. We have been able to keep a program of roughly $10 billion per year going forward with refinement, continuity, consolidation of effort, refinement of effort through this period over multiple years. That's unprecedented and extraordinary, and it's rested at the end of the day on presidential leadership. The Obama administration showed significant guts, I think, in rescuing the Global Fund, in rescuing the response to the Ebola crisis, and today in trying to labor in this next upcoming week at fixing WHO after we had such a catastrophic sequence of events. We have multilateralized successfully, as Deborah has told us. Gavi is in a much better position today than before. The Global Fund went through crisis, came back stronger. We have introduced in this era a very aggressive health security agenda through the Global Health Security Agenda itself. The $5.4 billion that came out of the emergency Ebola money, $1 billion to create capacities for detection and response and prevention of outbreaks. That leaves us with a question of what comes next. We do not know if there will be continuity on that side of things. We know the drama around the Global Health Initiative, which was attempting to overcome fragmentation and bring unified leadership, that did not succeed, and there's still the outstanding question as we go forward as to, is it possible to bring greater unity of effort, oversight, and the like across a system that performs reasonably well, but which continues to call forward for initiatives that could bring greater unity. What is this next political environment likely to present us with? The SDGs have gone forward, but as one of the polls showed, 80% of Americans don't even understand what those are. So we have a framework that sets targets in a coherent way that has not been embraced nor understood by Americans. And I think that simply falling back on moral obligation and national security arguments only carries us so far. We need to be able to embed our actions in something that will be intelligible to an American public. Right now, the SDGs are not intelligible or useful. They will become more useful in time, but I think we need to focus on that. The widening global disorder, the largest human crisis that we've faced since World War II, is disrupting politics in Europe. It's causing agonizing situations that we are not equipped to deal with, and the price tag is going to be very substantial. We need to make sure that the agenda we're talking about is linked to answering those problems, and it does not become a zero-sum problem. We know the agony that the Republican Party is going through today. We know the dangers of a nihilist, anti-establishment a sentiment that could disregard or consciously and actively eviscerate worthy programs domestically and internationally. That risk is very high right now, and we don't know where that is moving. The surveys that were done didn't really get into this question around the surprising and very fast-moving picture within the Republican Party and the soul searching that is going on and the agonizing debates that are going on as to where this is going to go. But I flag that, along with the widening global disorder, as one of the biggest threats to preserving a bipartisan leadership and coalition. Whoever's the next president, that president requires a strong and durable bipartisan consensus within Congress and in a broader American public. We need a functional Republican Party that is coherent and committed. And I think we're at a certain hazard about this. NCDs and climate change have been mentioned. The absence of big wins. We need to ask ourselves, Governor Thompson, I think, rightfully exhorted us to have big goals that will excite people. We have some very big goals that are very important right now. They are not going to necessarily be attainable in a dramatic and definitive and categorical way immediately, but they're going to be ones that the American people have to continue to be reminded that we're making progress on malaria, on HIV, on polio. But these big goals are ones that I think are going to carry us way beyond this next phase. So thank you.
Thanks. Really quickly, because I know there's questions we want to get there, on the task force that you've just launched, yeah. And picking up from what Helene said, can you just really quickly remind us what the goal is? Helping people understand the real successes that could be had with addressing women and girls more directly?
The task force is on women and family health. We chose four sectors, reproductive health, family planning, maternal and child health, immunizations, and nutrition. We chose those as four sectors that remain vitally important, that should be integrated in a better fashion, and this draws into one of the big meta themes that Jeff and Liz's analysis revealed in terms of sentiment, the desire to see greater integration. But it's going to be very difficult. These are areas where we believe there is a well of support for moving ahead. There's a momentum. There's been substantial progress and greater consciousness of the centrality of this agenda for the future. When we went to recruit the members of this, there are 23 members of this. There's a website that I'd urge you to go to that lays out the goals and the membership and the like. But on the membership side, we enlisted Helene and John Hammergren, the president and CEO of McKesson, to co-chair these. They're both very active trustees of CSIS. Then we went out and enlisted members of Congress as one priority, and we were able to succeed in enlisting six members, three Republicans, three Democrats, equally divided House and Senate, and that really astonished me. And it astonished me because there is an appetite on the Hill to find a worthy and compelling goal where they can demonstrate and commit to an area where substantial progress is possible. And this is an area that excites, to go back to Governor Thompson, this is an area that excites and people, builds on a sense of momentum and success, and an opportunity to carry this forward.
Yeah, I was just going to add one other thing, and it's back to the comments around the issues around women and girls. I think that the area of family planning and reproductive health, which is such a key one when we think about child health and women's health, that has been a divisive issue. I think the very response that we got to this task force, I think, shows that there are enough people who want to figure out a way to talk about this issue that has been divisive in a way that really brings people together. And so I interpreted some of the eagerness to really be able to talk about how does this fit in the broader context of saving the lives of children and women and not use it as a divisive factor. So, you know, I think there continues to be this eagerness to have global health and the issues around global health be something that brings people together as opposed to tears people apart.
And DREAMS is an example of
yeah, this. But we have to be honest, and we talk about integration. There is no integration for the care of young women between five and when they're pregnant.
Yeah.
So there's nothing to integrate to. So we have to create the systems, and we hope DREAMS will be part of that. It's multi-sectorial. It's very difficult. We've never tried it before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think what we're trying to do is build on the knowledge that PEPFAR has been successful and using that to take on some really high-risk issues of driving down incidence by 40%. But when you look at where the issues are, there is no health care from the time you are five to the time you are pregnant. So I think that's the kind of bridge that we all have to work on, because there's nothing, there's not binding sites to integrate to. So I think we have to be honest about where the gap really is, and then figure out, do we strengthen the school system for health? And do we ensure that there's school systems of health for primary school? And do we get girls in secondary school? And do we use education to drive down gender-based violence and improve health? All of these issues we're having to take on within DREAMS. But we think it will be very valuable to this initiative, where we're really having to be very, really honest about what health looks like for young women. It actually looks worse for young men and men in general. So we have to also be very realistic about that. There's really no binding sites for men between 25 and 45. And when you're trying to get them to acknowledge that they have HIV and they need care, I think we have that problem in the United States also. But look at how behavior can change. Look at what's sitting up here. He has a Fitbit. I have a Fitbit. Helena has a Fitbit. All driving behavioral change. So we know that, you know, people do accept
bipartisanship.
It's good for keeping time.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, I'm sure you look at it also. But, I mean, we know there's better techniques and technology now that we can tap into to really help us both monitor and really improve health in a different way. Who would have thought that Tommy Thompson would be wearing a Fitbit?
I had one before us, though.
I know.
He's had one.
I handed out
10 years ago.
I handed out thousands of these when I was secretary, as most people would know.
We do.
Last word before, I know you want to turn it over, but you mentioned something, Debbie, that came up in the polls that I just want to return to, and that is the issue of the social determinants of health. Yeah. And having for the last decade been in a development organization where health was part of a development agenda, I do think that's another part of the future, is how do we look more at integrating health into the broader arena of development, or even in this country, you know, community development writ large, and looking at issues like education, like access to adequate nutrition, which then gets you into agriculture and productivity, financial inclusion. So there's a whole umbrella of other things that I think we need to, as we think about how do you maintain some of these gains when they are so linked to broader social issues. And so it was interesting to see that the social determinants are starting to pop up a lot more as people think in a much broader way about what actually influences health at a community and an individual level.
Jenna, and I'd like to just, you know, Steve is my friend. He's an avowed Democrat, and that's his problem, not mine.
And he doesn't wear a Fitbit either. But
I want him,
before he leaves the feeling that the Republican Party is on its way out, I just would like to point out that I'd much rather be a Republican in this presidential election than a Democrat with a 75-year-old socialist wants to spend 90% in a president candidate that's being under investigation. So I think the Democrats got as many problems on their side as Republicans. And let's face it, you know, there's the old surrogate judge from New York who said, if you like good laws and good sausages, the best thing is not to watch them being manufactured. And I think presidential politics is the same way. Everybody's on the right, on the Republican side for a while. Democrats are way off the. Can you imagine a Democrat candidate saying we want to tax all of you 90%? I mean, that's going to move very much to the middle after the primary is over, and the Republicans will. I think we're going to have one of the most spirited and exciting presidential campaigns ever, and I think we're going to have a very good president that comes out of it no matter what. And that president is going to be much more moderate than what the campaigns are at this point in time. Mark my word.
And all I was going to say is I need to go get a Fitbit. thank you. So let's go to questions. We're going to take three at a time. Please, when you start your question, say who you are. And if it's directed at somebody, let us know, or if it's a general question. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi, Jonathan Daniels with Aris. A great panel. Appreciate all of your different versions of incredible enthusiasm. One of the things I was really curious about that we didn't really touch on in this panel is the role of research and development in driving some of these programs. So PEPFAR being a great example of this. a wonderful program probably wouldn't have been able to exist without the immense amount of money funneled into R&D for antiretroviral drugs and other HIV prevention forms. So very curious, and you know, looking at TB as another example, I heard mentioned that if we can handle the HIV issue and we can handle malaria, we'll also cut back on the incidence of TB. But I think there is broad agreement within the TB stakeholder community that new tools are going to be necessary in order for us to really handle the TB epidemic, and certainly looking at drug-resistant TB. So I'm curious as to what all of you see the role of government and also public-private partnerships is in funding R&D for global health issues, not so much on the domestic side, but funding them for diseases that are more of an issue abroad.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Next question. I think we had one here and then here. Or wherever.
Latasha Lee, Senator Brown. So I kind of echoing his conversation. We heard a lot today about HIV/AIDS as well as malaria, but could you speak more to TB, especially multidrug resistant TB, and the effect it could have here in the U.S., especially since the reauthorization of the domestic TB policy was not fixed by Congress?
Thanks. And last question for this round, letting them figure it out.
Trade Union Sustainable Development Unit. Thank you very much for your presentations. Very insightful and right on target. But those of us who work in the international advocacy community are seeing universal health coverage suck a lot of air out of the room. So I'm wondering, since it wasn't mentioned here at all, if there might be something added to your remarks.
So we have three questions, one on R&D, one on TB specifically, and one on UHC. Does anybody want to take?
Can I take the research one?
Yes.
When I was secretary, we were able to double the amount of money that went into NIH, and NIH has been sort of level funded since then. But the truth of the matter is, the NIH is one of the most exciting and most wonderful institutions that the government of the United States has ever funded or set up. There's tremendous research going on. I'm in the private sector right now. I'm involved with 30-some companies, all in startup healthcare, and I'm absolutely amazed what's out there. And what's really going to take place, we are going to find a cure for HIV, and it's going to come sooner than I think what most people in this room expect. And I've got a company that's right now is on the verge of trying some a new vaccine that looks very promising. I know Tony Fauci is working on this day in and day out, and we got to. And in infectious diseases, as Helene has pointed out and knows much better than me, is something that we have all got to be concerned about. And the way we win is through research and development. And there's so many wonderful scientists out there. We need to encourage them. We need to find more money for NIH. We need to get more money into small startup companies. Like, and BARD is doing that. And BARD has been a great organization, and it's going to be very helpful. I only wish Big Pharma would not have gotten out of the research and development end of it. I think they made a big mistake, but they have. They're waiting for small companies to come in, and then they buy them, and they put them in, and up the prices of the medicines, which I, you know, that's a free enterprise system, but I would much rather have seen pharma spend some of their own money to discover some of these cures. But I am very excited, very optimistic about cures coming in the area of research and development, and thank you very much for the question.
I'll be really quick about the R&D piece. I think Dr. Fauci and others are really doing extraordinary research, and we hope for both the vaccine and the cure, because what we're going to try to do is control until we get those. Right. But I think the other research piece that I'm very excited about what's happening is the dialogue between program and research, and using that as a dialogue. That didn't really exist before because we didn't have the level of data to really drive the next set of questions. And I think that dialogue right now, and the millennials' innovation ideas, which I find quite extraordinary because they don't seem as encumbered with dogma as we were growing up, or traditional pieces. So I think we are really seeing incredible ideas out of the millennials based on their ability. We may not have been great at integration, but they have no problem linking about
500 dots and coming up with a new solution. So I think between the millennials and the work that between program and research, it's incredibly exciting. Very quick on the TB issue. I think we have to recognize that there are different drivers of TB, and we have to be responsible for stopping the TB that we can stop today, which we know we can stop 75% of it if we go to test and start, because we know if we can get people on treatment before their T cells drop, they won't have reactivation of TB and they won't spread TB. So that will take care of a significant component of TB. But there's a whole nother part of TB out there in Central Asia and Southeast Asia that we all have to collectively take very seriously. And I think the new initiatives and the new strategies will really help with that. But we do have to do, we just finally got one new drug for TB. Mm-hmm. We're talking about something that's been around hundreds of years. So, yes, much better R&D in TB. We have to recognize these are the difficult diseases, but they've driven how we think about immunology. Things that reactivate, things mm-hmm. that hide, that's helping us with herpes. It's helping us with cancer. So, mm-hmm. I mean, these diseases will help us take on broader diseases, but we have to recognize that these are difficult. But we certainly have to invest in the research, and we need newer, fast-acting, less side effects drugs for tuberculosis.
Yeah, just one other point on the R&D. I mean, I think obviously hugely important. And I think, as an example, the new malaria vaccine that GSK and with Gates Foundation funding is launching, you know, that's incredibly exciting. And I think we've got to continue to balance, you know, how do you make sure that something that is often driven by market forces has other partners in it, the government, private philanthropy, et cetera, so that the needs of poor communities around the world get met. And so I think, you know, again, the malaria vaccine is a great example. That said, I think, you know, we always have to balance this, how many new tools versus how much of what we already know isn't getting out there. And are we doing the kind of research that Debbie was talking about that is more focused on innovation sometimes in programs, and how are we being more effective in how we get out the things that we already know work? So, you know, always, you know, I think that balance. Nothing to add to the TB drug other than, again, that's an area where there needs to be research, because as we continue to have this evolution of multi-drug resistant TB, it will need more technical solutions as well. And the universal health coverage, I didn't say it specifically, but I think those are the kinds of things when we start thinking about how are we going to actually set up systems that work for the broadest number of people, because ultimately it's setting up health systems that is going to have the greatest long-term impact on the lives of people around the world. And it goes back to one of my earlier points, is that we can't do this thinking that this is only a public sector endeavor. And I think more and more innovation around how the private sector models around health and health insurance are going to be important if we think about more universal access to health services in Africa and Asia and around the world.
Couple of quick points. On R&D, we've had a series of international panels looking at the Ebola experience, the Stocking Panel, the Harvard London School Panel, the National Academy of Medicine, which just rolled out last week, and then next week will be the Secretary General's high-level political panel. There's quite a bit of momentum and continuity across those panels in pushing for the creation of some type of new innovation fund. The price tag varies from anywhere from $1 billion to $3 billion that would be used to incentivize industry and others to develop and share more broadly, but to identify some of these dangerous pathogens that have been sort of orphaned, as Ebola has been, because it was not seen as having sufficient scale to warrant the kinds of investments needed. I think that's very encouraging. I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity in the next year to build off of that emerging consensus. It's going to require a nucleus of determined governments, foundations, and others putting money in the pot and contributing the leadership to move that forward. But I think we're at a moment where in the next year something could happen that would move us ahead dramatically. On MDR-TB and TB writ large, The White House issued its MDR strategy December 22nd, a very important move. It's still to be determined what that means for money. When the new WHO study on global TB came out, it made clear that really, for the first time, we're officially declaring that this is the largest infectious disease killer worldwide. So I think on those two major points, consciousness and awareness of the magnitude of the challenge has changed. And I would hope in the next administration we'll see more resources, more leadership, more unity of effort around tuberculosis. I think also we need to work much more closely and more effectively with industry. There are a lot of solutions that are out there on HPV, on hepatitis C, and other things that it's difficult to get access and delivery of those cures to the populations that need them. And that requires greater U.S. leadership and leadership by others to figure that out, and it requires very close interaction with industry. UHC, universal health coverage, I'm glad you raised that, Rob. That's a central theme of the G7 summit in Japan in May, and it's a reflection of a broader reality, which is that there is a sea change that's been underway now globally in low- and middle-income countries towards trying to build these systems, and this has become a sort of broad umbrella under which that debate is happening. We need to be part of that. I think there's no inconsistency between that and what Deborah was saying about the need to attempt to build on our investments at integrating at a local level. And I think it's consistent with many other things that are underway in building basic global health security capacities in West Africa. I actually think this is an encouraging development.
Great. I think we have time for just two questions. This has been a great panel. I hope you think so, too, because I could listen to you all for another couple hours. But yeah.
Hi, Carol Treston, Association of Nurses in AIDS Care. I was really appreciative of the discussion around moving away from disease silos to strengthening healthcare systems. And, clearly that speaks to the role of nurses, and especially strengthening not only the role of nurses, but the number of nurses in healthcare systems globally. And so we know we're moving into task shifting, but in addition to that, thinking about expanding the role of nurses in the healthcare response, much like we're seeing in the United States with nurse practitioners and advanced practice nurses. And I was wondering if the panel could talk for a minute about some what seems to be common sense answers about increasing the number of nurses and the number of and the authority, practice authority of nurses within the scope of some pretty limited educational systems and pretty restrictive practice authority in some countries. So some of the barriers and possible some of the solutions to expanding the role of nurses in this response.
Great. And last question.
Hi, I'm Erin Roberts, and I'm just speaking for myself. I have a comment and then a question.
Quick,
so,
as long as it's quick.
Okay, yep. I'm very wary of the emphasis on public-private partnerships, especially with the large multinationals and their foundations. Ultimately, corporations are profit-driven, period. And at the end of the day, their agendas are totally opposed to the global social change that is required for a truly healthy world, like a universal living wage, worker protections, and food and land sovereignty. We talk about climate change and its effects on food security as if it was not created by agribusiness and the energy industry, who we partner with in our global health endeavors. So I'd just like to know if you could speak to some alternative ideas for funding, or if we are sort of tied to private partnerships, how do we make them, how do we leverage them to where we can benefit and we're not sort of riding the coattails, ultimately forming our agenda around theirs? Thank you.
So the nurse's question and then public-private partners.
So really quick on the nurse, thank you for raising that. We believe strongly in the role of nurses, and obviously we've supported improvement in nursing education writ large, not just for PEPFAR, and the task shifting. But let me just make a comment to all of you, because I know you work in the global health arena all the time. Please go back to all of your partners. If you have task shifted to a nurse, make sure you've task shifted some of the nursing responsibilities to another cadre.
We've just task shifted everything to nurses, so they're doing 10 times more. And they're, you know, we just need that other health cadre to help with that. And I think countries are figuring that out for routine immunizations, for routine diagnostic tests. And so I think that training of a health cadre underneath the nurses and then continuing to strengthen the nurses is absolutely key. We have changed our approach to public-private partnerships to... We don't accept what private sector wants to bring to us. We go out and say, this is a new big initiative. What can you do as part of that, and do you want to be part of it? So that we're not changing the initiative to align with private sector. We're saying, come with us for a program that we want to roll out together. And I think that's just a little bit different twist on it. And I think if you start from that position, you get unbelievable private sector partners who want to work with you around the exact same vision and impact.
I'm overriding my last call. We're asking one more quick question, and then we'll go right back to you. Yeah, just one
second. Thanks, Jen. So I'm Jim Glassman, former Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and co-founder of the Strategic Health Diplomacy Initiative. And by the way, proud member of Tommy Thompson's entourage on that trip to Africa. So I'm just a little bit worried that we're going to leave here a little too sanguine on the political situation. You know, Steve, I think Steve raised some negative points, but the fact is, on table one of this survey, it says the question is, you know, would you say the U.S. government is doing enough or not doing enough to improve the health for people in developing countries? And Democrats, 52%, small majority, say not doing enough. 24% of Republicans say not doing enough. I think this is a serious problem when you consider the fact that it was Republicans, President Bush, and with tremendous support from a Republican Congress, that started this public... And Tommy Thompson, absolutely, that started the global health explosion in funding, and support is declining. So I wanted to ask the panel what we ought to do about it as far as messaging is concerned. And I think both of these surveys really have some good indications. My own feeling is pushing the national security argument, but I'd just like to hear the panelists. Okay. Thanks.
So last comments from our panel.
Number one, the nurses. My daughter-in-law is a nurse. My niece is a nurse practitioner. I went all across the country when I was secretary trying to get more people enrolled in nursing. Now the big problem is not people going into nursing, because we have plenty that want to go into nursing. We don't have individuals becoming doctors, PhDs, and professors to teach enough nurses. Second, we have to drive down a lot of the regulations so nurses can do more. Nurses are expected to do more, and they're hampered by the rules and regulations. We got to get rid of that, because nurses are the frontier. They're the first line. I'm all for you. I'll do anything I possibly can to get nurses to do more in the operating room and in the hospitals. In regards to the lady, I would not subscribe motives to big nationals enough and start criticizing them. Without their money, we're going nowhere. And much better to get involved with them. Let's get big goals. Go out there and get as much money as possible to fight whatever we're going to fight. TB. It's a great cause. Let's go out and build a program around getting support from both the public and private sector to fight TB, fight malaria, fight neglected tropical diseases, fight HIV/AIDS. There's enough money in this wonderful country, and we have the opportunity to do so. As far as messaging is concerned, we just got to do a better job. As far as Republicans are concerned, they want big goals. They want accountability. And we can do that, Jim, and thank you for being on the trip. Thank you for what you've done in your past. But I really think that this is a bipartisan issue. Global health can be, if you can set it up as a way to show that we can prevent infectious diseases coming into America, we're going to be able to prevent infectious diseases. It's a big issue, both Republicans and Democrats. When Ebola came, people were worried. They didn't look around if you were a Republican or Democrat that were going to be stricken by Ebola. It's, you know, it's an equal opportunity infester. So you better be able to get all the people supported. And warfare, You know, if a country has got huge problems, if you look in the past history where countries have huge problems with neglected tropical diseases, with HIV, they're an unstable government. Unstable governments cause ISIS and other nefarious groups to come in. You got to get Republicans to realize that this could be something that we could use in order to protect our public defense and be able to prevent a warfare. These are the kind of messages, and Democrats and Republicans need to work together.
I think he's the message.
But just quickly to thank Jen, because as always, Kaiser ahead of the game, really putting out there the next step. And to say to Jim about his comments quickly, what the Bipartisan Center just put out mm-hmm. about showing the impact of these health programs on democracy, on governance, on economic development, really, Congress may not be interested in the ones that you talk to, but I think that story of what can be driven by these programs is really quite extraordinary. So thank you for your work in really making that clear.
Yeah, just a couple comments on all three of the comments. First, on the nursing, I think totally agree, but a lot of focus needs to be on the policy shifts in the countries, because everyone knows, you know, and I'm a physician, but, you know, doctors have hijacked in some ways care and have blocked the ability for non-physician providers to do the things that they actually can do quite well. And so I think we've got to work on, you know, breaking down some of the policy barriers, and that will take some real strong advocacy in countries in which we're working, along with our own government. But really, a lot of it is at the level of the countries that we're talking about. So it's just an area that I don't think there's been enough focus on. How do you make those policy changes so people can take up these tasks? And as you said, not do what we often do, which is to then overload people so that, you know, we're breaking the backs of the very people who can have an impact. On the public-private partnerships, I mean, I understand the skepticism. On the other hand, there are two renewable sources of funding in this world: taxes that come through the public sector, and economic that are created by purchasing and purchasing power. And so the private sector does have a huge role, because if we're talking about sustainable ways of funding, it is important that we look at what are ways of linking with the private sector. And the private sector is as vast as any other sector. A lot of work that's being done is with small and medium-sized enterprises that are very much launched from the very communities that we're talking about. So I think we shouldn't kind of have this blanket approach to the private sector when it is one of the renewable sources of creating economic financial flows, which are so important for sustainability. And if you look at any country, it is because of creating economic value that social value is created. And so I think we shouldn't look at those two things as opposite, as if economic value sets on one side and social value creation sets on another. It's the only way that society has advanced is when we advance together. And I think your example of how do we put that together and think about that smarter is the way, you know, that I think we can drive it so that it doesn't only meet the economic incentives and economic goals, but economic incentives are incredibly important for driving things in a variety of ways, including social issues. And I think the final issue around how do we get this back on the agenda? I think the polling data give us a wonderful handbook around what are the messages. There is no one message. There are messages that will meet the needs of different constituents. I have my own favorite message because I know what I listen to. I mean, I know what incentivizes me. But everybody is incentivized in different ways, and that's why the messaging, I think, is so important. And I think we've got to get back to the days where we were bolder about using our messaging in a much more aggressive way than we are. I think in some ways we're almost a victim of our own successes. We think that, you know, we now have a lot of resources. We're making a lot of progress, but I think we should think about rolling back to the days when we were actually pretty aggressive, when people were chaining themselves to offices. Now, do we need to go back to that? I don't know. But I think we've got to get back to the point where there's a sense of urgency, a sense of righteous indignation about the fact that lives are continuing to be lost around the world unnecessarily. And I think we've got to put that kind of urgency back on the agenda and use the messages that are for the right target audience and start using some of the kinds of techniques that marketers do to get those messages out there to the right audiences.
Thank you. On the nurse question, I don't think I have a whole lot substantively to add. My mother's a nurse, so I've been imprinted for several decades with that perspective, and we certainly carry that forward in our work. During the Ebola crisis, we saw of the 500 victims, health providers, the majority were nurses. We look at what happened in Dallas. It was the nurses who were those who bore the secondary infection. They carry enormous risks and responsibilities across the board. Jim Glassman's question, I agree that that number, that 24% number, is something that should give us pause, that we should be looking at that as an evidence of a steady erosion and a potentially worsening vulnerability on the Republican side, and we should keep our eyes open, wide open about that. I think that what that says to us is there has to be active renewal of from the Republican side at the leadership level to get those numbers back up, and we have to be consciously avoiding applying partisan labels to initiatives. All of the achievements of the Obama administration in global health are, in one respect or another, based on bipartisan support and build on the Bush administration legacy. And that point has to be made over and over again. In the current deteriorating political environment within the Republican Party, there is a hazard of applying partisan labels to things that are not worthy of being cast in that way. And we need to be very conscious of that and working very hard to avoid partisan labels being slapped on things for the sake of trying to break things down to demonstrate your virility in destroying sort of governing achievements. As far as industry, I share Helene's very eloquent statement. There's a lot of soul searching within industry right now. Industry is essential in terms of supply chains, bringing forward commodities, discovery and development of new tools, be they vaccines, therapies, diagnostics, other devices. They account for a huge share. The private sector accounts for a huge share of the delivery of health. We've had problems in developing the functional and meaningful dialogues with industry because there's lots of barriers. WHO has been broken for years in this regard. More needs to be done there. There is a high-level panel that the Secretary General has pulled together on access, which brings many of the most progressive leaders of industry together with the advocates and political leaders on a fast track, which, as I understand, will deliver some recommendations in June. I think that's reflective of the fact that of the shared awareness that we have tools for HPV, for cervical cancer, for many other pressing needs that we can't get on an affordable basis to the poor folks that are suffering or at risk in an effective way, and we need to do much better. And that's something that could be made a priority of this next administration in Congress. Thank you.
Jeff, you wanted to say something
just
really quickly.
Jim, for your question, in messaging research that we also did with public opinion strategies, one of the things we found with Republican voters is that attaching this in a kind of a very bold way to American exceptionalism is really quite powerful, is to talk about our work in this area and our kind of our moral commitments as part of what makes America different and better really appeals to a lot of Republican voters. The other thing in this research is we did an experiment, is we gave half of a sample lots of messages about the benefit. This is really about foreign assistance funding more generally, about kind of the need for and the benefits of what the United States does. And the other half of the sample, we just told them one thing, is that it's only 1%. And the half of the sample to whom we said it's only 1%, moved more dramatically in support of global foreign assistance funding than this other half of the sample that got lots and lots of messages. So I think making sure that people understand that it's not 20% or 40% or whatever number was 31. In that poll is really important in terms of keeping people on board.
So I don't know about you, but I could stay here for another couple hours having this conversation, but I'm cognizant that we've hit up against our time. So I want to thank Jeff and Liz for the research that they did to contribute to this. Very helpful. Thank you. And really, please join me in thanking Governor Thompson, Ambassador Birx, Dr. Gale, Dr. Morrison.
Thank you, Jen.
You're going to send us your advice on which Fitbit we're supposed to get, right?
Thank you to all of you for being here, and I'm going to go get a Fitbit now, and I'll see you another time.